Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of the Star Ledger podcast. Alongside Connor Orr, to my right, wearing a drab gray shirt, I'm Mike Vorkunov.
Does that make your sweater vest, is that any less drab than mine, or is it?
I think this a little this gray. The sweater vest
is very nice.
All right.
All these floating Express logos.
Is that what it is?
They're sponsoring our show.
Oh, okay.
No, that's not true at all. Not at all. But Connor, we're taping this, just so everybody gets a clue, on Wednesday, April 18th. And this comes one day after the Devils have fallen down 2-1.
More importantly, 2 days after players reported for voluntary workouts.
Tim Tebow
debuted
as a Jet.
Right. But anyway, we'll start with the hockey.
One day after he was named to the Time Top 100 Most Influential Athletes list,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That dude seems very influential.
See, that's why you can't, you just can't get away with leading a show with the hockey when there's just so much football going on.
Did he place higher than Jeremy Lin?
On
that list, on the Time list.
Probably. I mean, you know, Tim Tebow's the fourth most recognizable person in the world.
Who are the three ahead of him?
What did it was Oprah, Kate Middleton, and somebody else. I think it was the Pope.
Mm.
Three before him. The Pope is the only one I'm not sure of, but I mean, the Pope's got to be up there, I'd guess, as far as recognizable figures.
I'm surprised he's not ahead of Oprah. I mean, she doesn't have a show anymore. Nobody watches her network.
But she puts herself on the cover of every single one of her magazines.
No one buys her magazines.
It's still in business.
If you put yourself on the cover of every magazine, then no one buys.
Anyway, so the hockey started yesterday. That's what you were saying. You were there. Devils, Panthers.
Devils, Panthers, it was a tough loss. They had a 3-0 lead to start out, and then it just went into disarray as Clemmer, the former Devils backup goalie, Scott Clemmensen, pitches a shutout for the last roughly 54 minutes. And did you watch it at all? This is your moment of truth.
No, I watch a lot of baseball now.
Okay.
I'm just not a hockey guy.
No, it's fine.
You know, but it did surprise me that I don't know. I don't know the tendencies of hockey coaches as opposed to... I guess I understand the tendencies of football coaches and baseball coaches a little better, but if you're... Why do you... Was Martin Brodeur that bad? Was it his fault? Because they pulled him, and that's kind of a surprising thing.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing I'm still trying to figure out. Brodeur said that he was just trying to, maybe change their fortunes at the time. And Brodeur, he talked about his lack of success last night in this, like, fatalistic way. He said, the puck just couldn't find me, which is a weird way for one of the best goalies ever to talk about his job.
Right.
As if he's some kind of just vessel of fortune to make saves. He just said the puck couldn't find me yesterday. And I think it's kind of reactionary more than it is, how he played. Rather, it's the same thing with Clemson came in after Jose Theodore gave up 3 goals in 6 minutes.
Would you compare that to what would you compare that to? I mean, is that like replacing Jeter at shortstop in Game 2 of the World Series and he's batting, zero for his last 50 or something like that?
I think there at least you have some kind of you have some tangible grasp, right?
Yeah.
Because so many things go into giving up a goal. You know, it depends if you're being shielded. It
depends on the
shots
being
taken from.
That's what I'm saying. So then why, if there's so many other things that go into it, I guess why, if you're that Devil's coach, why do you take him out?
I think it's just because they want to change a momentum. When things are going bad for you, you want to just completely change everything around. It's like in basketball, I guess, when you have, someone goes on a 10-0 run, so you're like, all right, that's it. All the starters are coming out. Put my bench and go a full 5-man on the fly rotation change.
Hmm.
That's the best I can guess.
It's like in Dodgeball when he says, crazy strategy. Let's see how it works out for him,
That's what Pete DeBoer was just saying. Well, it didn't work out for him, but it worked out for the Panthers last night.
This is 1-1.
It's 2-1.
2-1.
2-1
Panthers.
You know
that's
what,
right.
I'm interested in?
2-1 Panthers.
How much not hockey have you watched?
What do you mean?
Have you watched any of the playoffs?
No.
I was going to say...
I'm a baseball guy.
I know you're a diehard baseball guy.
I think...
Let me ask you what you think of this. The whole thing now during the playoffs has been a lot of guys getting doled out suspensions for giving up hits. Like Carl Hagelin of the Rangers.
I did see the Penguins and Flyers thing.
The Penguins and Flyers to a small degree. But you had Shea Weber, who started the very first night off of the playoffs, by literally... maliciously ramming Henrik Zetterberg's head into the board several times at the end of the game, and he got a $2,500 fine.
Okay.
And then Carl Hagelin got 3 games for arguably a dirty check against Daniel Alfredsson, because Alfredsson is going to miss a few games. So it seems like they're putting the suspension based on what the damage is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a good way of going about things?
Well, the first thing is, what I don't understand is the outrage. You know, there's a ton of outrage over the Panthers and the Flyers and, you know, all these people fighting and getting suspended and stuff. I mean, why, you know, when these people do this all year and they build up these vendettas against other players or this hatred of other players, why do you all of a sudden expect it to just go away once the playoff starts? It's probably going to be 10 times worse because there's so much adrenaline and there's so much, you know, and I don't have a problem. I mean, are you asking me if I have a problem with the guys being suspended or the way they're
being suspended? It just seems odd. It seems like it's completely reactionary.
Yeah.
You're rewarding or you're penalizing the result rather than the process.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think,
like,
that's
if Hagelin hits him the same way, but Alfredsson doesn't get hurt
right.
for as long, it's now not as bad a hit.
Should be determined by the action. And not
I mean,
result.
I would say the guy who rams the other player's head against the boards is probably it's probably worse.
Yeah, I mean, think about, you know, you don't want to think about that, but all the wrong turns that somebody could take, twists and turns, you don't know what can happen with them. But
and I like what you're saying there about the way that there's fighting now. The funny thing is, whenever you talk to a hockey player in the playoffs about something that's going on, like I asked them about, I think I asked David Clarkson about that hit that Shea Weber had, and he's like, "What you think of it?" He's like, "Well, you know, it's playoff hockey. It's more intense." Their answer to everything is, "It's playoff hockey."
But it is. I think it's like...
It just completely takes over everything.
Yeah. But I think that's the reason for everything. I think that's the reason that there's harder hits now. I think there's a reason that there's better goals. I mean, I think that all kind of factors into it. I mean, I wouldn't expect it to be worse. I mean, you know. But anyway.
I just find that to be a weird answer for everything. Like, you know, why are you playing on a broken leg today? It's playoff hockey.
Jack Youngblood played an entire season for the Rams on broken leg. Or played the entire Super Bowl on a broken leg.
That was playoff hockey.
Broken leg.
Yeah. They used to be tougher in that day.
Yeah. Speaking of football.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Schedule back to Tebow?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a fine segue. And before we get our Star Ledger baseball columnist Jeff Bradley on to talk about the MLB, the surprising Mets, and all that kind of stuff. But I think just quickly it's important to address that the world's most important sport,
soccer,
has released.
Soccer, we're gonna have to apologize to Jeff. He's missing the beginning of Chelsea-Barcelona right now.
Really?
Semifinals of the Champions League. He's going to kill us.
He is going to kill us. That's a good point. But the most important sport in the world.
In America.
American football. Just released their schedules yesterday, and 2 days ago reported, and I just love how much the NFL has become a year-round thing now. I mean, they did a countdown to the schedule release, and fans already knew the home and away opponents. They already knew all that. They already knew who they were playing, just not when, but all of a sudden you have a schedule release party just so people find out when they play the specific teams. I think that's insane. It's crazy. I mean, I like it. I like how it's become such a big thing, but I
think it's ridiculous. I think you and I have different...
Can you imagine if they did that for Major League Baseball?
we're playing the Braves in game 98.
Oh,
my
man.
God.
Circle that on the calendar. But seriously, I mean, like, I think that's... the NFL just does such a good job of hyping themselves up. I mean, look at... For example...
they have some help.
Yeah. Yeah, but look at what, like, Major League Baseball did, right? You had the opening weekend in Japan, and then everyone, at least, you know...
Well, no, I didn't know there was an opening weekend in Japan.
But there was.
No one ever talked about it.
Right. Nobody ever talked about it, and then there was another week of spring training, and I think there was that weird period where the very casual baseball fan was kind of like, well, is spring training over? Or
and
we still
all,
have a little bit more time to go? Or?
We were trying to figure out what it means for our fantasy teams, and...
A lot of stuff.
You know, that's horrible planning by baseball.
Yeah, I had Cespedes. I think he had 2 home runs in Japan, and they didn't count.
Yeah, well, I mean, you should take that into consideration.
But anyway, football coming up. One of the big things.
Enlighten me on the schedule.
Well, I think, you know, obviously I'm on the Jets beat, and so I took a really good look at that yesterday. And four primetime games for the Jets a year after going 8-8 is pretty incredible. They have the Thanksgiving night game against New England, which is going to be pretty crazy. And then they also have the two Monday night games and a Sunday night game, I want to say. So, I mean, right away, I mean, that's pretty crazy. I mean, that's sort of the NFL's way of, you know, of saying, yeah, you guys are still the most entertaining entity that we possibly have.
Well, I think that's the beauty of the Jets is that by saying that, the NFL is acknowledging that you don't even have to be a good team. Like, your drama, if
the NFL
you blow
is totally
up,
aware of what people are interested in.
Well, to them, a 4-12 Jets team is just as interesting as a 12-4 Jets team. Because the drama that comes with that and the New York market.
Right. I mean, what I'm saying is, it's just incredible to me that, it's almost like the UFC model of, like, promoting things. They know what people are going to watch. They know what people want to see. And so they just hand it to them. So why not put the Jets against their most hated rivals? It really has become kind of a bigger than New York, New England kind of thing. I mean, in my mind. But, yeah, I mean, they knew what they were doing, you know, and I think having it that way is pretty smart. The Giants, on the other hand, I mean,
they've got an interesting one too. I think you start out with the Cowboys in week one, and
we should first plug that Jenny and Mike did excellent jobs breaking down the schedule, which you can find on NJ.com.
And Mike did a great job breaking the schedule, which I found that to be especially delicious. The fact that he scooped the NFL Network on the schedule, which serves the NFL Network right for making it into this. Some kind of holy grail of a 3-hour TV show.
You're right.
And, I mean, that just serves them right in terms of that.
But, yeah, if you guys have a minute, do check out what Jenny and Mike have to say on the schedule.
It's on NJ.com.
NJ.com.
Yeah. But I think, as we were saying, week one you have the Cowboys, which is obviously made
that's another
TV.
That's another thing. The NFL knows exactly what they want. You know, 8:30 Wednesday night. I mean, you know, they know exactly what they want.
I mean, I will probably watch that. I think in case New Girl has moved to a Wednesday night, I may win out for the first half.
What's going to happen if Whitney moves to Wednesday night?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. They kind of lost me at the end of the season when she got engaged. Spoiler alert, obviously, for all the fans out there.
Do you think there are people that are... Do you think the one Whitney fan listening to this, which is you, doesn't already know that? Or...
Well, you know what? I just want to make sure that I look out for everyone who's listening. Yeah. You know what I'm actually interested in? The week three at Carolina.
Well, you're skipping right over. I mean, for our Jersey listeners, you're skipping right over the most important game, which is week two. Greg Schiano and the Buccaneers come back to New Jersey.
And that same week, that Thursday night before that, Rutgers goes down to South Florida.
Oh, really?
So you could have a whole wave of Jersey and in this area writers go to South Florida for that.
You could have a Kyle flood of writers everywhere.
Oh, how long have you been saving that one?
Not at all. I mean, it's sort of... I'm surprised that I remember what he's saying. To be honest. But anyway, if we're looking at, you know, just straight up looking at the schedule, I mean, you know, the Giants, there's a lot of tough stretches there. I mean, they obviously have the toughest schedule in the NFL this year, but not one that I think is impossible for them. I mean, I don't look at the schedule and say that there's no way they're not going back to the playoffs. I think they're going back to the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, but that road schedule is so sneaky hard. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Carolina on the road in week three on a Thursday night game.
Yeah.
You don't want to face Cam Newton when he's hyped up.
At Philadelphia on Sunday night, you don't know about. I mean, the Eagles, to me, are going to be kind of the biggest come-from-behind team from last year. I mean, and if there were two more games in the season last year, three more games in the season, they would have made the playoffs.
Based
on how they were firing, you know?
Look at the stretch. Week six at San Francisco, week seven, Washington, and considering the troubles they had with Washington last year, then week eight at Dallas, week nine Pittsburgh, at Cincinnati for week 10, and then it's a bye, and you're like, all right, good, the coast is clear. Oh, wait, it's Green Bay waiting on the other side of the bye week.
Yeah, I mean, that's a brutal stretch. I mean, you talk about, you know, who knows what the Redskins are going to look like, who knows what the Steelers are going to look like. Personally, I think the Steelers are going to have a down year this year, just kind of based on how old they're getting. But, I mean, that's not an easy team to play.
I think every team is getting old.
It's true. Every team gets a year older.
I think that's the aging process.
There's not one team where the players are getting
younger.
Every
picture of you is of when you were younger. It's a fact.
It's trippy.
It's weird, I know.
Now that we're getting into the metaphysical, that probably means it's time to
Yeah, I gotta say, though,
do some baseball.
Yeah, we should probably call up Jeff Bradley and have him on to the show, but I do got to say, the one thing I do love, and I think we're going to make a three-hour show of this ourselves, the NFL draft.
Oh, yeah.
Right now, you're doing the previews. You have the quarterbacks out today. You have the running backs out tomorrow. Yeah. But we will. I think we should do a special draft show.
Yeah, no, we can.
Have Mike and Jenny on.
Yeah, no, that'd be cool.
Jorge?
We will.
Okay.
We will.
Because I can talk about that for hours.
Yeah. And we could talk about how Brandon Whedon's not my top five quarterbacks.
Oh, look at that.
Which I've already gotten emails about today. So that's always fun.
That's good. That's a good...
It's a good segue into our draft preview.
Yeah, so you can expect that in the coming weeks. Well, next week, actually.
Next week.
Considering it's the 26th, 27th, and 28th.
Correct.
All right. That's enough dilly-dattling for us. How about we bring on Jeff Bradley?
Sure. Sounds good.
So we have Jeff Bradley. He's calling into the podcast, and Jeff Bradley, the Star Ledger baseball columnist. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
Hello, Mike.
Connor alongside with me.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jeff. How's it going? How's everything?
I'm good. How are you guys doing today? What's up?
Well, you know, as you're driving, or you know, we're kind of just got finished up watching the Mets game. Not going too well for them today, but is it safe to say, I guess, from your vantage point that they've been a pleasant surprise up to this point?
Yeah, I have a feeling today's going to be the day Terry Collins busts out the old, there's going to be 50 games this year where we beat the other team and 50 games where the other team beats us, and how we do in the other 62 is going to be what determines our season. That's just my gut feeling on the cliche of the day.
Is that a new sabermetric principle?
No, that's just in over 20 years of covering baseball. That seems to be the favorite cliche on the day you get your butt kicked. but I think the Mets, it's so early, as you guys know. You knew I was going to say that. But the only thing that makes me think the Mets actually have some type of a chance to compete this year for something, whether it be the wild card or even the NL East, is I think that the Phillies and the Braves, you know, the Phillies have taken a big step back. Offensively, they're just anemic. And I don't believe in the Braves, and I think, you know, we'll believe in the Nationals once we see them perform at a high level over a longer period of time, but just the fact that they're the Washington Nationals gives us, you know, sort of a pause. So, you know, I do think that the Mets, you know, if they can ride this out and have a good month, you know, then maybe sometimes you start to see that 2006 Detroit Tiger, see, I told you we were going to be the fundamentally sound team and everybody's on the same page. And maybe then a little magic starts to happen, but it's probably a little too early for that. And I think the one starter that they put out on the mound who's convincing right now to me is John Neese.
Yeah.
But I'm not as big a believer in the knuckleballer, R.A. Dickey, or even Johan Santana at this time. I just think Santana is going to have to win the way Pedro Martinez had to win when he wasn't Pedro Martinez anymore. And I think he can do that, but it's not going to be lights out all the time. You know, when you're topping out at 88 and you're trying to fool guys, it's a lot different than when, you know, on a bad day you can still miss bats and break bats. So I don't think Santana's going to be lights out all the time. I do think he can be a good starter as long as he can take the mound, and he's going to have games where he dazzles. But, you know, I don't know that this team – I think a high bar to set for this team would be, say, 85 wins. But I do think 85 wins this year might keep you in the hunt for something.
Well, yeah. 85 wins, you tell Mets fans at the beginning of the year that 85 wins is in, you know, their window. I think they go ecstatic.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to look at this in all different ways with the Mets. In spring training, they looked so pathetic. But again, they were dealing with injuries. They started the season well when they had everybody healthy, and now here we are already dealing with some injuries. But most teams that don't have, you know, at least three starters who go out there with the potential to get some strikeouts and dominate you are going to struggle to win, go on long winning streaks. And let's face it, the Mets don't have overpowering starters at all. Most of these guys are going to induce contact, and then you're hoping that you get the balls hit at you, or you know, if a guy like Mike Pelfrey, you hope that his sinker is really working. Dylan G, I think you're always just kind of hoping that, you know, he has, it's funny, he actually gets decent strikeout totals for a guy with his repertoire, but again, I think you're hoping that the hard-hit balls are fine gloves with him, because you know that a few guys are going to light into balls. It's a likable team. Terry Collins is, you know, you can't help but like Terry Collins and the way he's so old school, and the way he handles everything, and even the challenge of guys to get out there and play injured. And you know, I know that some Mets fans aren't crazy about that because they've seen backfire in the past. But as a guy writing baseball, you sort of love that old school style that Collins brings.
Yeah, one of the things that I kind of liked about Terry was he was telling a story a couple weeks ago where him and Joe Girardi drove into their spring training game together, and it seemed like Girardi sort of paid him like a lip service compliment, like, "Oh, you guys actually have a pretty good lineup this year." And Collins just turned to him and said, "Yeah, I know I do. Like, I know I do." And I think that kind of speaks to what you're saying. I mean, it seems like he's almost the perfect fit for what these guys need right now.
It's giddy times right now, just having gotten off to a good 11 game start.
Yeah.
I do think that when they're healthy, it's not a bad lineup. Right? I mean, if you were to take it piece by piece and say that Ike Davis is going to give you a healthy season, and say that that David Wright's going to give you a healthy season, and you know, then and say you can get something close to what Jason Bay used to be. But these are a lot of ifs. The injuries, you hope, you know, and every team can fall prey to injuries. But, you know, it's not a bad lineup when it's fully functional. But when there's a step off, if Bay doesn't produce or if a guy gets hurt, that's when the Mets look anemic and look like a team that's going nowhere. And that was what I was watching in spring training. But then, lo and behold, on opening day, they put out a pretty healthy team and were able to get off to a good start. You know, I just find the team... it's one of those things we're not supposed to root, but the Mets having a good first half would be, I think their fans deserve it, and it would be a lot of fun. It's just fun in New York where you already get the feeling in the Bronx that they're just going to sort of go into that mode of just let the games play out and know that when all shakes out, there's going to be 95 to 102 wins and a postseason berth, whereas with the Mets, you know, every week seems sort of like make or break.
Yeah.
are we going to stay in the hunt? Are we for real, or are we going to go back to what we used to be? It's actually more compelling to view early on in the season than the Yankees, because I think with the Yankees, we all know there's a 10 out of 11 or a 10-game winning streak, or, you know, a 13 out of 14 just waiting when they go and play the weaker teams.
Well, Jeff, let me ask. I mean, you talked about Johan Santana and how it's going to be difficult for him. And obviously the key to maintaining the start of the full year is if you have the structure to have that long-term success. And I'm wondering, is there that structure there, especially with David Wright? I think it's been encouraging. You know, he had that fractured pinky, and I think in years past where there was idea he might go on the DL, he would have ended up on the DL for 3 months. And now he comes back the next day and hits a home run, and he's raking to start the year. Is he going to be able to, or do you think he'll be able to come back to that superstar play he was?
No. and that's strictly going by the history of his injury. I think that the only guys there have been guys who've come back from capsule tear surgery, okay? Guys like Frank Tanana. I don't know if I'm dating myself. You guys may not remember.
I think Connor has a Frank Tanana jersey.
Frank Tanana was a flame-throwing left-hander with the California Angels. When he reemerged following this type of surgery, he struggled to throw hard again, but he had such a good feel for the ball and knew how to pitch that he was able to reinvent himself. I don't think Santana has to reinvent himself totally, because he's always been a power pitcher with finesse, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But now I don't think there's really much of a chance that he can return to being a power pitcher with finesse. I think he has to be a finesse pitcher, which he can do because his changeup is so good, and his command of his pitches is so good, and he can put the ball where he wants it. But most hitters will tell you that a fastball on the corner that's 94 miles per hour is a lot harder to hit than a fastball on the corner that's 88 miles per hour. It doesn't mean that you can't get guys out with that, but it just means that there's going to be nights where you're not as perfect as you need to be. And, you know, he relies on getting guys to chase the changeup out of the strike zone. You know, it's a long-winded way, Mike, of saying I think he can be good. If he can make all the starts, I think he's going to win a lot. I think he's going to at least keep you in a lot of ball games.
Really?
I don't think he can be dominant. I really don't. You know, dominant in terms of wins, he could put up a nice win total, but it's going to be every game you're going to wonder which Santana is going to be out there. I don't see him as a guy now who's just going to be lights out.
You joked about dating yourself with the reference before, but I know you and I were just going back and forth momentarily on Twitter when you were talking about at Yankees opening day, comparing the 2012 opening day to the first opening day that you covered for the Daily News back in 1992. Give me a picture of what opening day for the Yankees was like in 1992 and just some of the things that you remember from then that are just such a stark contrast from now.
Yeah, it's the last hopeless Yankee season, 1992. And we knew going in, it was my rookie year on the beat, and we knew going in it was a bad team. And the only difference between that team and teams prior to that were bad, and a lot of people may not remember that the Yankees were bad for a lot of years. You know, probably they were competitive through, say, 87, I guess. I'd have to look it up to know. 87, 88, maybe. And then they really started to fall fast in the 89, 90, 91, 92 years. And spending money in bad places and not being able to lure free agents. The stadium was empty. So in 1992, they came in hopeless. But of all things, they started off the season 6-0. So my first year on the beat, this team, if you saw the lineup, I can't recite it verbatim. I can't recite it. Oh, let's see. Randy Velarde, I believe, was your leadoff guy. I could go position by position. It was Matt Noakes catching. It was Mattingly at first, Pat Kelly at second, Randy Velarde at short, Charlie Hayes at third, Danny Tartable in left. Center field was Roberto Kelly, and right field was Mel Hall.
Wow.
The starting pitcher was Scott Sanderson, who was a journeyman right-hander, who was old. So that's what you were looking at back then. And the only difference between 1992 and the few years that were bad that preceded it was that they had this young manager, Buck Showalter. And Showalter basically said, you know, this is a year where we're going to find out what some people are made of. Okay, so they let guys go out there. They let pitchers throw innings, even though they were getting their brains beat in. There wasn't the old Columbus shuttle. George Steinbrenner was actually banned from baseball at that time. So Showalter and Gene Michael were able to blood some players. Okay, they were able to bring up Bernie Williams and get him significant time. They were able to test out some arms like Scott Kamenicki and you know, some younger guys. They brought up a lot of pitchers that year. The only pitcher they had who was even decent was a guy named Melito Perez, who was one of the famous Perez brothers. Their bullpen was shaky, although they had a pretty well-paid closer in Steve Farr, who used to blow saves and tear up the clubhouse. but it was a team that what happened was that you could see that maybe the wheels were set in motion, that the Yankees were going to take a year and set no high expectations, but they were going to see what was in their system. And you know what? 93, they improved drastically, and they were in the hunt right up till the end. 94, they had one of the best records in baseball up until the strike ended the season. 95, they won a wild card, and 96, they won a World Series. So, you know, the 92 team was poor. I could go into some graphic stories of we had Steve Howe, who's no longer with us. We had Mel Hall, who's doing 45 years in prison. we had a cast of characters that I don't think the Yankee organization would be too proud of in some ways. Not all of them, of course. You know, Mattingly was still hanging in there at the time. But, you know, they had a lot of hopes in guys like Pat Kelly, who never turned into much of a star player, although he was billed as one at the time. You know, that was an interesting way to cover games. So, you know, the big difference between opening day 1992 and now is that you've had 20 years of success. The Yankee Stadium, there's expectations. I sense, and if you talk to other people my age, that the Yankee fans are very, very entitled now. I think they go out there and you don't really sense that raw intensity because they just kind of know things typically work out. And the games get fun later in the season.
Do you think that there's one Star Ledger podcast story about the kind of the wildness of the 1992 Yankees that's appropriate to share?
Well, I mean, the thing with the 92 Yankees, okay, it's not to give people, you know, baseball beat writer horror stories or whatever, but I was a relatively young writer my first year on the beat, and in spring training I had to deal with Pascual Perez failing a drug test, and I remember Yankee officials, we'll call them, sources, basically looking at me going, don't act like this is a bad, don't write it like this is a bad thing, this is a good thing. you know, we had Steve Howe in and out of baseball 6, 7, 8 times for failing drug tests and violating his probation. The Pascual Perez one was funny because here I am in Fort Lauderdale covering spring training, ready to write about baseball and the America's pastime, and we were searching the strip joints in Fort Lauderdale, looking for Pascual couldn't drive because of some things that didn't allow him to drive. We'll just put it. And, he did like the nightclubs where the ladies took off their clothes. we went on sort of a search of Fort Lauderdale, trying to find Pascual, and I never found him. Although Don Burke, who was not with the Ledger at the time, Don Burke was with, you know, Moss would want to hear this, but I don't think Moss and I tracked down Pascual that night. But Don Burke and John Heyman found him at one of the strip joints and were able to get him to say that there's no way the drug test was right. But we never saw Pascual again in a Yankee uniform.
How did they want you to act like it was a good thing when they asked you to write it like it was gone? Oh, okay.
They had enough. And basically saying, you know, if you're going to write like this is a big deal for us to lose this guy, that's not really accurate. You know, this is a guy who, if the drug test is, if everything holds up and he's done, we'll be glad to wash our hands of him. You know, the funny thing or the touching thing about it, though, was that his brother was on the team, Melito. And Melito had never had any trouble at all with anybody, and he was a very humble, nice guy and a good pitcher. And I think they were a little bit worried about maybe people associating Melito and Pascual. And Melito did not speak great English, although he tried. And I remember him just saying, "You know, I'm not him." So it was actually fairly poignant. And the season, like I said, it started out 6-0, and now here I am, my first year covering the Yankees, and I'm thinking, "Hey, you know what? We're going to shock the world, and this is going to be fun. It's going to be like old times." And it doesn't take long for a 6-0 to turn into reality. And I hate to throw that at Mets fans and say, you know, it is what it is. But you really do have to let things play out. I used an analogy that I think Bobby Valentine liked. When the Mets were 4-0, I said this is the equivalent of being in first place 4 minutes into the NFL season. 4 minutes into week one. Now we're at the 11-game mark, so basically we're done with week one in the NFL. So it's, you know, if you're in first place now, it's the equivalent of getting off to the 1-0 start in the NFL through 16 weeks. And it does just take a long time for you really to get the feel for whether a team is for real or not.
Hey,
you know, we'll see. The Mets bullpen actually has surprised me. The Mets bullpen, the back end of their bullpen, can lock up the close games. You know, who knows? Last year I wrote it a bunch of times. I really believe that if you can get to 120 games, okay, and be 60-60, you can legitimately make a run for a postseason spot most years.
Jeff, were you married at that time in 1992 at the spring training?
No, I wasn't. No, I was very single.
I was going to say, how would you explain to your wife, you know, what you had done that night for your job?
Or to the Daily News when you had to fill out your expense report.
Yeah, that would have been weird.
No, I don't think I could have put that on any expense accounts. I think my wife would probably understand, back then especially, things have calmed down a lot on the Yankee beat. The Yankees have become the organization that doesn't really fire managers anymore, and stability, and I think that, you know, now Yankee fans can look up north 217 miles to Boston and say, ha, look at that chaos. And I remember specifically interviewing David Cone when he decided in the 1993 winter meeting, I want to say, or 92, might have been 92. We met with him, and it was after the 92 season, the winter meetings, the Yankees made a push for David Cone. And Cone was there, and he met with the Yankee writers, and he said, he signed with Kansas City, okay, just to show you the sign of the times. He went to his hometown team, and he signed with Kansas City. And David Cone just said, it seems very chaotic, and it's a very chaotic organization, and that doesn't appeal to me. And, you know, you look now, 2012, five world championships, been to the postseason every year but one, stable farm system, promote their best players. There really is nothing that Yankee fans can complain about. If it's going to be nitpicking over, you know, not winning the World Series every year, then, you know, so be it. But the times have changed. I mean, and if you ever get Moss Klein on the podcast, he can tell you even better stories.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to do that. Yeah.
I read Moss when I was growing up in Essex Fells. I'm an Essex County kid. And the, those were the glory days with Billy Martin. And it was real crazy then. And I know the beat writers actually had to try to go out at night, and they worked those hours in the hotel lobbies and things like that because they had to. It wasn't that bad when I covered the team, but we still had the occasional misstep by guys.
I think we'll get him on. I think he even
you got to get him.
He wrote a blog earlier this year talking about how it's just too calm. It's too boring with the Yankees nowadays.
It's so different. It's so different. I tweeted this on opening day. I said, I miss the angst-ridden Bronx of my youth. and it was just, you know, look, the stadium now is beautiful, and you can have a steak dinner and a martini. And the Yankee Stadium, where I was covering the team in 92, was a pretty angry place with a lot of empty seats. And if you were to look at, like, the early video, probably on YouTube, of Paul O'Neill's early years with the Yankees, and he would hit these home runs into the right field seats, and it would just hit a sea of blue seats.
No bleacher creatures.
But the bleacher creatures were there because the bleacher seats were cheap, but the language and the drunkenness, and you could hear it throughout the stadium. There were cheers that I can't say, you know, because my kids might listen to this, that were directed towards Ken Griffey Jr. And I remember just sitting there thinking, man, this place is just angry. And you'd say, who would want to come play here? it was just a different time. I talked to Lou Piniella about it. We did a Piniella story this winter where, I just kind of drew off the theme that it really was incredible that Piniella never came. When Piniella left to go manage in Seattle, to go manage in Cincinnati, I think that if you could have gone to Vegas and said, you know, how many more times will Lou Piniella manage the Yankees before he's done as a manager, you would have probably put good money on at least three more times. And he never came back again. And Piniella said, you know, it took a guy like Joe Torre and the success for Steinbrenner to sort of realize that stability is a good thing, because he had so much success earlier in his run with the Yankees with the volatility, you know, the fire and ice method, you know, where you'd hire Billy Martin and replace him with Bob Lemon, and then you'd hire Martin again, and it was you know, I equate it to what they're doing in Boston now, that they think Bobby Valentine, because he's the anti-Francona, can shake things up, so to speak. I don't really know if that works so well anymore, because I think the players don't really like it when they have to answer all these questions before games about what the manager said. Just a different time in baseball history, I guess.
I wouldn't mess with Euclid if I was...
He's a big dude.
Yeah, Valentine. He seems like a pretty serious dude.
Yeah.
Hey, if anybody on there.
Jeff, thanks so much for your time. I know you got to get to your son's game.
Thanks, guys. Anytime. Yeah.
I hope you come back on sometime this year.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you very much.
Anytime.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
See you later.
All right, and that was Jeff Bradley, our baseball columnist for the Star Ledger, telling great stories. And I want to hear more stories of those early 90s Yankees and
the intrepid
80s Yankees.
The intrepid strip club search.
Yeah, he made it sound like you're on, like, the beat is like a Ramones concert, and now you're on the beat, it's like a Justin Bieber concert.
I don't think that, I don't think that, you know, the beat writers now and then, I think, you know, the work is still very difficult. I think it's just a different kind of difficult.
No,
like
definitely.
Back then, I think, you know.
I mean, the stories and the
back
craziness.
Back then it was a strip club search. Now it's like the fact that baseball has become a 365-day-a-year job, you know, with the off season and with, you know, all this other stuff.
It's just different ebbs and flows.
Yeah. But, I would like to...
I want to hear what Moss Klein has to say about those 70s Yankees.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that would be
Billy
tremendous.
Martin.
Yeah.
And Reggie Jackson. And Billy Martin plus Reggie Jackson.
Yeah.
Those we got to have them on sometime.
We'll call it Moss is Burning.
Oh.
The Moss is Burning.
That is great.
Yeah.
I think we're going to have to do a special podcast.
We're making so many promises. It's like 3-hour draft special, 9-hour Moss special. Everybody, yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? I think Jeff was so good. We really should probably stop there. I don't know how we can top those stories.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tapped out of ideas. Unless
we have to go back to planning and making more false promises.
Unless you want to recap. I mean, did you want to run down all the Whitney stuff, or do you think that's Whitney? Not Whitney Houston. Whitney, Mike's favorite TV show.
You know, I think Whitney. That should be its own special podcast in the future too. Just an all Whitney podcast.
Yeah, really, just sort of. Do you think that she would come on with us?
We could try.
You think so?
Yeah. I don't know how podcast friendly she is, just in terms of her language.
Is she a? See, I'm not a fan of you. Is she a?
Well, I don't know. Have you heard her stand up?
No,
her stand up. She's very frank.
She's like Lisa Lampanelli.
I guess. I mean, only because people listen to her, unlike Lisa Lampanelli.
Yeah.
But I guess she's of that same vogue. We'll see what we can do.
It's not Bill Cosby.
No, it's not Bill Cosby.
Jeff Foxworthy.
Although I went to a Bill Cosby concert.
Me too.
He got kind of graphic at times. He could still throw a few fastballs.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Next week, Bill Cosby's still got his fastball.
I think that's the cue to wrap it up.
Indeed.
All right, so thanks a lot for listening. This is, I think, what, episode 2 of the Star Ledger podcast?
Yeah.
Hopefully you'll come back and you'll listen to this episode 3. And for Connor Orr, I'm Mike Warkanoff. See you guys next time.
All right.